Welcome to Season 5 of the Fight Science Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Sullivan. In this series, we are further expanding our knowledge by speaking to experts in the fields of physiology, psychology, nutrition, strength and conditioning, and mindset training. We'll be speaking to the coaches and practitioners who do this every day and to the researchers and academics who are at the forefront of the sciences. Today, our guest is once again Charles Stuhl. Charles is the Performance Nutrition Manager at the UFC Performance Institute, Las Vegas. Over the past 18 months, Charles has been pivotal in designing and implementing the UFC and Trifecta's Fight Week meal service, in which they assist with the nutritional needs of fighters making weight during Fight Week. 2020 has been a crazy year for everyone, but none more so than the UFC. I've gotten Charles back onto the podcast to chat about what it's been like coordinating the meals of all the fighters during this crazy time. As if Charles wasn't busy enough, he has also contributed an entire chapter to the new UFC journal all about nutrition for traumatic brain injury. In this episode, Charles will detail his major recommendations for athletes who have sustained some damage to the head. There's a lot of good info to get through, so let's get to it. All right, green light means we are live. So back for another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. So joined once again by our very good friend, Charles Stuhl, a.k.a. the Angry Dietitian. Charles, thanks so much for coming back on, mate.
My pleasure, my pleasure. What a year it's been.
What a year it has been, hey, and we're finishing it off. It's Christmas Eve here in Australia and then Christmas Eve where you are, and we're both working. What a year. That just sums up COVID, hey?
Pretty much.
Hey, let's talk about that, Charles. First thing that we want to do, let's chat about this. It's been a crazy year, and the UFC have led the way with this. For everyone that's listening along, I'm sure you've all are well aware of what the UFC has achieved this year. It's monumental. It's probably the biggest, I would say the biggest thing to happen in sports, in modern sports, I'd say. You've kind of defied all odds. But with that, there's this huge workload that comes with that, and there's all these people making this machine run and pushing these wheels. Give us a rundown. I want to hear, what was it like for you? What was the year 2020 like for the Angry Dietitian?
Well, the start of the year was pretty standard, right? It's like you're assigned to one or two cards a month, and pretty slow and steady. And then after February rolled by and March started, the world kind of went to a standstill. And you know, all events were postponed. Talks of doing some fights in Tachi Palace in California, driving out there and driving back. All of the creative ways that the upper leadership were coming up with to try and keep the show going. But finally, May rolled by and we got the green light to start shows in Florida. So the first shows back were Jacksonville, and we did, I believe it was three cards in 2 weeks. So overlap. It was us first starting a bubble. So a lot of eyes on us in terms of the protocols that we were going to come up with. And man, it was pretty stressful, but we did it.
What were some things that you learned like straight away, Charles? Like, what were the immediate challenges when you got to Jacksonville? Because like you said, it was a bit crazy and you had to put all of these procedures in place and you had to do it in a really fast time. What were some of the big lessons that Jacksonville taught you?
Well, beyond just Jacksonville, for all of the year, because the PI team essentially became essential staff, just because we could provide and maintain that, we could maintain the bubble by providing all athletes with the opportunity to utilize food and supplements and physical therapy treatments through Fight Week, we became essential. So we started going to every single event. But first and foremost, especially with that Jacksonville card, there were some very interesting things that we noticed and some things that carried on through the rest of the year. Because a lot of fights were postponed, we had some athletes that came in super light and lighter than we'd ever seen them, but super overtrained, right? Because literally their fight was scheduled in March and it kept getting postponed until May. So these guys coming in at 6%, who normally don't ever come in at 6%, but you know, overtraining, can't sleep, poor recovery, you know, all those signs and symptoms. And that's how it started. And then as the cards rolled by and, you know, COVID's hitting, corners are getting pop positive, whole team's quarantined, bike gets pulled, last minute replacement. And then you start seeing the guys coming in who basically had a 2 week or even less fight camp. And that was a whole nother ball game. And we basically don't ever, we never have a sigh of relief until the fight happens. Because there's so many checkpoints along the week where a fight could potentially get pulled. And because of that, we're always on our toes and we're always ready to react. Because, I mean, when an athlete comes in over fight week, I've talked about this before, but there's a whole comprehensive screening process, nutritional status, but also just food allergies, right? So that whole process has to happen very, very quickly to make sure we meet the needs of the athlete when they're coming into fight week.
Yeah, and that's crazy. I've said this before on the podcast. I'll say it again because it's phenomenal what you guys do. And I always say, like, sit back is what I do and what other practitioners in my position do is we have, even if they are short fights, we work with these guys all year round. So we just have data sheets after data sheets on these guys and we have so much information. Then you guys, like you said, like it could just be a 2 week fight camp and then they pop up and then it's like, here you go. This is your problem. Fix it. Make it happen. Get them on the scale. Yeah, make it happen. It's wild. But you guys do it. Let's move on to Fight Island because we've gone Fight Island 1, Fight Island 2, and just announced, I think it was just yesterday, wasn't it, that they're going to be doing Fight Island 3. So 3.0. So, Charles, let's talk through Fight Islands. What were they like? What was Fight Island 1 like? And then how did that influence Fight Island 2? And then what's happening with Fight Island 3? Is it the same protocols or what are you guys planning for that?
So Fight Island 1 was, well, first off, Jacksonville was crazy, right? and then all of a sudden, I thought it couldn't get any crazier, and then it was Fight Island, right? So I think with the Fight Island, there was so much mystery behind it, which, I mean, certainly some of it was planned because it kept a lot of media attention, right? And eyes are on everybody. So let's just say planning for the logistics of Fight Island without knowing all the constituents of what was required in terms of the quarantine regulations, both in the US and then over in Abu Dhabi, how much time we'd be stuck in our rooms without not being able to leave, certainly created some chaos, let's just say. And big shout out to Mario for, especially on the first Fight Island when it was him and myself over there, not really knowing what to expect and basically being released from quarantine the night before check-ins, where basically at check-ins we have to have all the food prepared for every single athlete. Needless to say, an incredible effort. Second Fight Island, a lot smoother. I was for a couple of weeks, but Reed was there for the entirety of the 5 weeks. Poor guy. Definitely a lot smoother logistics. But you know, the same challenges, a lot of more international fighters than we're typically used to, language barriers, different cultural norms, weight cutting practices, some very interesting ones. Just being exposed, you think you've seen it all, and then a fighter comes in and just blows your mind. So, and as you mentioned, just a day ago, we found out about Fight Island 3, and I mean, the planning process starts again now. It's food, fluid accessibility, supplements being sent in, multiple time zone shifts, multiple different fight cards being on local time as well as US time, all the challenges that we have to overcome when we service a fight card internationally.
This would be an interesting question. I want to hear it, Charles, because like you said, then you get all the international fighters. And I guess for us as practitioners, like I have a method and a procedure that I put my fighters through. And so we kind of have a practice that TFD does. That's our weight making process. And I'm sure the PI has that as well for all the fighters that, you know, you guys work with all year round, but that's not the way it works on these fight arms and these fight cards. What do you do when these guys rock up, are you more there to support the fighter and just run with these interesting practices, or are you trying to push them into the PI's model, or how does that all work?
So first and foremost, especially when there's a, like the fights are, some of the fights are like at 2 a.m., right? So you basically have an option of doing U.S., staying on U.S. Time schedule, or just hopping into the Abu Dhabi time schedule. And that really dictates the time at which you initiate that acute weight cut process, right? As well as how much over you are. Some guys have to split it. Some guys do it right before weigh-ins. It depends on the percentage over you are. With some of the more interesting approaches, we're definitely there to guide and push people towards what we deem as a perhaps more safe and sustainable method of weight cutting. It helps, especially when we're the sole providers of food, and that good luck going to a grocery store. There isn't one. So in that sense, we have a lot more sort of say and power over incentivizing athletes to follow our model. But at the end of the day, if you're really, really gung-ho about following your method, and let's just say you're not eating what we're giving you and you're going off to the restaurant to have burgers and fries, then there's not much we can really do.
Let's talk about something else that's kind of been happening in the background all this. So you guys have had this crazy year, been extremely busy, yet you've still been able to write version 2 of the UFC PI journal. That's been happening. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah. So despite the nonstop events, we've also been cranking away at putting together the second UFC PI journal, which completely dwarfs the original one. This one is just a massive undertaking and so multidisciplinary. But I think the approach of this second one too is going to be a little more digestible to everyone, because it's in more of an infographic model. Although there's a lot of information in it and a lot of detail, it's in a lot more digestible form. But it also has some MMA-specific publications that are going to be in there, thanks to our Shanghai team, who've really been systemizing the training approach to, takedowns from the cage. You know, here's A, B, C, D, and how to do it, what to do, what are the percentages that work the best, et cetera. So it's truly exciting to be rolling out with this. And so far, so good. It looks like we're going to have the e-copy available to be downloaded Q1 of 2021.
Yeah, and a big reason why we got you back onto the show is to talk about your contribution to it. And it's looking at an area that's super hot right now, still in its infancy, but still really important, and that's concussion. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so one of the chapters that I contributed to was exactly as you said. It's sort of nutritional interventions and strategies for traumatic brain injury recovery. And I would say that I hope it starts creating some conversation around perhaps just brain health in general. As we talk more about it, we'll see that some of the things that we do to help with the recovery process, it's probably better that you're not deficient in these things to start with. But we'll go more into that. And of course, goes without saying, especially for such a novel topic, a lot of the research that, especially let alone nutrition interventions for TBI, as you said, in its infancy, and it just really relates to both the ethical considerations of research, but also just the complexity of doing traumatic brain injury research. It's not like a muscle biopsy, which you can do pre-post. It's a little more invasive. we've had access to some really great minds in traumatic brain injury research. Joel Totoro, who is one of the RDs that works for Thorn, actually brought us in and connected us with kind of the Thorn Brain Trust group, a lot of them do research at the Mayo Clinic. So just want to give a big shout out to Dr. David Bodick, who is a doctor there. And then Dr. Michael Schmidt. Yes. Just so big shout out to them. Really took the time to go through each and every intervention that we had and really give it their blessing. So definitely very, very grateful to have had their insights. So I guess I'll just dive right in, shall I?
Yeah. Yeah. Talk us through, all the, I guess the intervention and, you know, the flow chart.
Sure. Sure. So I think the best way to perhaps look at our interventions is really to understand just a little bit of the mechanisms that occur when there is a traumatic insult to the brain. And I hope if anything, this also stimulate some brains in your viewers of creative ways around nutritional strategies for traumatic brain injury recovery. So when you have a mild TBI, there's a traumatic depolarization of the neurons. And basically there is a energy crisis and energy deficit and an insufficiency of the ATP to reestablish homeostatic ion concentrations. And there's also changes in blood flow, typically poor blood flow to the areas that need oxygen the most. So that's really driving an anaerobic metabolism of glucose. The damage in of itself releases a lot of reactive oxygen species, furthering apoptosis and inflammation, right? And really, nutrition targets should be geared around mitigating that energy deficit, as well as managing inflammation, and really aiding that neurogenesis recovery piece, right? So really, when we're looking at traumatic brain injury, those are the things that we're looking at. So when you think about those components, and you look at dietary interventions that we have, I mean, managing energy deficits, managing inflammation, and creating an environment for recovery, that plays right into nutrition. That those are the components that we can definitely, as practitioners, have a profound impact on. So when we were thinking about how to create progressions, really, the progressions along the treatment and the rehabilitation of a traumatic brain injury are driven by the sports medicine team and the strength and conditioning team. So what we had was we had a tiered system of a progression, starting with, you know, your acute phase where basically you're not really doing anything. And then you kind of slowly graduate along, and it's done via vestibular screens, balance screens, C3 logic, as well as SNC has like a graded exercise test, starting with very low intensity aerobic work, slowly adding in resistance training. And the goal is to slowly progress all the way back up to full combat training and sparring, right? That's the goal. So our nutrition interventions sort of parallel those progressions, right? And kind of bringing it back to mitigating the energy deficit. The first thing when we think about energy deficit and how to mitigate that was the use of creatine. So first and foremost with creatine, it's basically an alternative mechanism for a non-glycolytic rephosphorylation of ADP to ATP, simplest way of putting it, right? What we do know is your brain has stores of creatine. Supplementation can influence the stores of this creatine, not as much as skeletal muscle, and that's probably because of its ability to pass the blood-brain barrier. And we also know that an acute injury lowers creatine. So with those things in mind, creatine supplementation provides your ability to mitigate that energy deficit. Now, because you need a fairly large dose of creatine in order to elicit any changes in brain creatine, we actually start with a pretty high dose of 0.4 grams per kilo. And I would say that if you're working with perhaps a heavyweight, you may consider doing it for fat-free mass. Otherwise, you'll be doing a whole tub. but this is like split into 5 gram doses throughout the day. And then as you're progressing along the stages of recovery, reintroduction of ESD work and progressing along and back to full combat training, then you return back to maybe a baseline dose of 5 grams per day. And of course, I'm merely talking about creatine in the context of brain recovery. Practitioners, especially those who have to work with combat sports, have to weigh the advantages and disadvantages of creatine. I lean towards the side of you probably should be on it if you can be, but if you're really, really, really tickling the edge of making weight every time, you may want to consider the risk of the potential hypertrophy as well as the water retention that's associated with creatine intake. So this is merely for brain recovery. So the next big piece is inflammation. So nutritional anti-inflammatories, basically dietary as well as supplemental flavonoids, have neuroprotective actions. This area of research is a little less robust. There's a fair bit in rodent models, but when you're nothing concrete in human models, to my understanding, and the dosages required to elicit much change was pretty high in the rodent models. It was like 50 to 100 milligrams per kilo. So when you, so here's the thing though, and we bounce that idea around with the guys from the Mayo Clinic. One, when you're publishing, you wanna see a change, so you kind of go with the biggest dose possible, just to make sure you can elicit all those changes in the inflammatory cytokines. And two, those tests are done in isolation. That's only one flavonoid to elicit a response. Their approach and their philosophy is that if you have multiple of these things working synergistically, you can lower that dosage. So on our end, even the lower end of the 50 milligrams per kilo is a ridiculous amount of curcumin to be giving anybody. So we settled with 500 milligrams three times a day. That's a higher dosage than is necessary to mitigate like delayed onset muscle soreness. But it is still a significantly large dose of curcumin. And granted, there are other flavonoids and anti-inflammatory compounds out there, and some that are researched in rat models for traumatic brain injury. We're also limited in a sense, especially with our athlete population, with third-party testing. What we had accessible to us was Mareva, which is a high bioactive curcumin supplement. So that's what we utilize as our preferred anti-inflammatory flavonoid. Next big thing in terms of inflammation management, mitigation, as well as neurogenesis is your omega-3s. So omega-3s also have a profound anti-inflammatory response and neuroprotective actions against reactive oxygen species. So even over fight week, I'm sure you may have noticed, we're giving brain armor is what we provide our athletes. We tend to go with one that has a higher DHA to EPA ratio. So when someone presents with mild traumatic brain injury, we actually give them between 3 and 9 grams a day, which is a fairly large dose. We shy away from the 9 grams, especially if our medical team deems that there's an active brain bleed, just to be careful. 9 grams is probably not going to accentuate that, but we're still erring on the side of caution. So, And granted, too, I'm kind of throwing out the supplements as our go-tos. There's, of course, a dietary recommendation that's tied along with omega-3s, right? Like consume a diet rich in salmon, mackerel, flax seeds, etc. Same with the flavonoids, right? Teas, spices. It's just when we're trying to get biggest bang for your buck, it's kind of hard to get 0.4 grams per kilo creatine from steak. That's a lot of steak. The next big approach that we have is really in the macronutrient distribution. And I would say that within the context of fueling an athlete for performance, I'm definitely not one to necessarily advocate like a very low carbohydrate ketogenic diet, but in the context of brain health, especially post traumatic brain injury, there is some pretty strong evidence that a very low carbohydrate ketogenic diet has some impact on brain recovery. And the real one of the hypotheses is when you have a traumatic brain injury, you have all those reactive oxygen species that are released. They cause a lot of single strand breaks in DNA. And what happens is there's this enzyme called PARP that's upregulated. So this like poly ADP ribosylase reaction basically siphons away NAD, which is an essential cofactor in energy metabolism, particularly glycolytic. It siphons it away and uses it to essentially repair DNA, right? So the problem is glucose metabolism requires substantially more NAD per molecule than a ketone body. So when you're on a ketogenic diet, it tends to spare NAD stores in the brain, thus hypothetically there's less of that energy deficit of the cofactors involved in energy production. So that's the true premise of the ketogenic diet that we're implementing. Not to mention within like larger macro scale, our philosophy around fueling is really about metabolic efficiency. So fueling the macronutrients based off of the intensity of training, frankly, in the acute phase and pretty far along the recovery path, you're not really doing anything that's truly glycolytic or high intensity. And so we really pull back on the carbohydrates. That said, you still don't want to completely omit all forms of carbohydrate. Like when I'm saying like some of the berries, which are really rich in flavonoids and phytonutrients, it's very important to make sure you're still dosing fiber to keep the gut healthy. And I'll go into that as one of the symptoms of mild brain injury that we're actually looking at and trying to manage as well. But yeah, so we'll continue with a ketogenic diet pretty far into the recovery process and then slowly dose carbohydrates, especially as we're starting to get back into more energy system demanding exercises and training modalities. So those are really the core components of what we're doing dietary intervention wise directly related to traumatic brain injury. But there are several signs and symptoms that come alongside traumatic brain injury, especially that we've noticed within our athlete population, which is why we kind of added this to our protocol. It's a hot topic right now as well, but the gut-brain axis, right? So when you have a traumatic brain injury, there is a dysregulation in that gut-brain axis, and traumatic brain injury can really dysregulate the gastrointestinal motility and exacerbate a lot of the issues like bloating and inconsistent bowel movements. So really we're focusing around dietary approaches of probiotic rich foods, you know, your kefir, kimchi, yogurt, sauerkraut, kombucha, but then also like the prebiotic foods, right? The fibers that you need to help that probiotic proliferate. And of course, from a supplementation perspective, your glutamine and your probiotic are also recommended in the progression. And like I said, with all these supplements, our goal is to wean them off of it when we deem it appropriate, once they're stabilized and able to go back to more energy system development work. And the last real big thing that we come across with traumatic brain injury is insomnia and circadian rhythm disruptions. So same thing, really, it's nutritional interventions and supplementation geared around reducing that sleep latency. So the tossing and turning, the inability to get restful sleep, but then also being really fatigued during the day. And it really starts off with a melatonin supplementation early on with GABA, which is our preferred like pre-sleep parasympathetic activator. Dietary intake of B-complex, tryptophan, and magnesium is probably insufficient because of how low carbohydrate we're fueling our athletes. So we may also supplement with that as well, if we deem necessary. And of course, like all things, the goal is to gradually wean them off it. You don't want an athlete that's dependent on melatonin all year round. Yeah. So that pretty much wraps up our nutrition interventions for concussion, brain injury, and generally overall, just brain health overall. But really, if anything, I hope it sparks some thoughts, because like I said, if you think about energy deficit, inflammation management, and neurogenesis, I mean, I think it can bring about a lot of interesting ideas within the nutrition community.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, Charles, when you're taking people through this, is there a set time frame for each one of these stages that you're taking them through, or how are you assessing how to move them through the stages?
So we kind of have like, it's stage one, stage two, stage three. Stage one is the initial period of rest. Stage two is energy system development, introduction, like walking on a treadmill. So really, nutrition is matching the nutrition prescription to the stage. It's not really us that determines what stage they can advance to. That's really the sports medicine team who gets them through the initial stages. And then concurrently, the SNC group who has a graded exercise test. If you're only able to tolerate a stage three, then you're probably going to stay at stage two. You know what I mean? And this process, I mean, can take months in some cases to fully progress. That pretty much summing it up, nutrition department doesn't really influence the progressions per se.
Yeah. Charles, you and I both spend a good deal of time getting punched and kicked in the head. So say for everyone at home listening in, and just say they're listening going, okay, this sounds brilliant, I want to do this in a preventative manner, how would you adapt these protocols to be more prevention-based?
So that's a great question. So I'll start first and foremost, like brain creatine levels. And once again, I'm going to put on the amateur scientist cap right now. And a lot of this stuff is being researched, and I'll actually go over it when we sum everything up, some good resources that people can probably follow along with. But hypothetically speaking, if your diet is pretty poor in creatine, I would say your resiliency to traumatic brain injury is probably going to be reduced. Maybe not the initial injury, but if you get subsequent ones, who is to say? Perhaps hypothetically, you probably would be less resilient to it. If your body has a really poor EPA to AA ratio, and AKA you're very inflamed, your omega-3 status is poor, you're probably at greater risk for poor recovery from traumatic brain injury. Same goes with any of your inflammatory pathways, right? And I will also add too, I think there's a lot of novel supplementation and protocols out there that, like I said, because we don't have access to third-party tested product, it seems promising, and who knows, down the road someone may incorporate it. But there's a lot of good research into simply NAD supplementation in of itself, right? And then the other thing that comes to mind, once again, it's kind of a hot growing topic, is lion's mane. That mushroom has been shown to upregulate nerve growth factor. So who is, obviously I can't say for certain if it helps with the recovery mechanisms of traumatic brain injury, but certainly sounds promising. So there's an array of other other products and supplements out there that may be quite effective in the recovery of traumatic brain injury, as well as resiliency for traumatic brain injury.
Yeah, and I want to just jump back into this because I know the listeners will be thinking it. Just going back to the ketogenic diet for brain recovery, if we were talking in terms of people using this as a preventative cause, obviously if these guys are training all year round, they're going full tilt, they need and using those glycolytic systems, like you said, you need to use the principles of metabolic efficiency, you need to fuel for that work and you need to do all that. Is there some merit in doing stages of ketogenic dieting for prevention from these potential TBIs that may happen? Or what are your thoughts around that?
My take is if you're going to be on a ketogenic diet and you're competing against an athlete who is not on one, you're probably going to get hit in the head more. You're going to be slower. just pulling your leg there. But that's the danger, right? It's like, oh, ketogenic diet we're recommending for traumatic brain injury. Like I said, I'm not trying to advocate for very low carbohydrate diet for athletic performance. I think Lewis Burke already came out with enough research to show that even in elite power walkers. So
speed walkers or whatever.
One sport that probably has any glimmer of hope for fat fuel oxidative pathways to outperform carbohydrate doesn't. So especially in a super explosive, fast twitch sport like MMA combat sports, I really can't be a true advocate for a ketogenic diet all year round.
Yeah, I wanted to get you to clear that up because I know for a fact there's going to be people who hear that and they go, yes, Charles said it, so I'm going to do it and I'm going to justify it because it's good for my brain. But no, I like that though. You would probably get punched and kicked more. Charles, let's just say someone is at sparring and they get like a concussion and it's at a gym, or if there's coaches listening or teammates or people who, you know, even just cop a head kick or a big straight right down the pipe and they go, oh, okay, I think I've got a mild concussion. I don't really have any of this at home. Can you just sum that up quickly? They're going to go, okay, I want to run to the supplement store, or I need to order something. What are they going to get the most bang for buck out of? What should they keep in their cupboard just in case this happens?
A high quality omega-3 supplement. You probably should be on one all year round. Creatine, if you can afford to take it, not from a financial perspective, but more so weight making, and as well as third party tested, please, especially when it comes to creatine. I'd say those are your big bang for your buck, and perhaps some of the better researched things out there. I would say that you should. I think every athlete should probably be on a omega-3 supplement. Just because it's quite hard to meet your needs from diet alone, especially in a combat sport where, let's say, 8 months of the year, you're in a calorie deficit.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, Charles, I want to, before I let you get back to your Christmas, I suppose, because while we're working on Christmas Eve, we don't know, but I want to ask you this question because I've been asking a few guests and you've just spent a good deal of time, probably about a year, writing a journal of all of the up-to-date knowledge of what we know in combat sports. And you've been in this field for a long time yourself and you've seen how it's developed. I guess as a profession, combat sports nutrition is still relatively new. It's a still relatively new profession and there's a lot of patches and misinformation. And really, if someone goes to Google and you Google, say, I don't know, endurance athletes, you could probably find some good practitioners and some good information. Combat sports, it's a bit harder to find up good information. I want to ask you, where do you see this field heading? Where do you see the field and the profession of combat sports heading into 2021 and further into the future?
So I will still say that I think a registered dietitian comes into play with a set of skills that really sets them up for success in this field, especially with being able to pull from food service, right? How do I find source, keep food in a, you know, temperature stable, all those questions that perhaps someone doesn't want to think about, but needs to have a safe and sustainable operation. But then at a whim, switch to this clinical mindset, right? Especially with post weigh-in, being strategic about the carbohydrate refeeds, what things may or may not exacerbate gut issues. Those are all the clinical things that we have to jump right into at a whim, right? So I definitely think, as well as let's not forget the counseling skills, right? It's not just about weight making. It's the 365 day approach to being an athlete. And I think a registered dietitian really has an advantage in those areas. I will still say that there is a pretty big gap between being someone who is comfortable working in general sports nutrition as a registered dietitian to what it takes to work in combat sport weight making. And I think the UFCPI, the fight dietitian, I think we all need to put our heads together to generate some kind of curriculum or just to upscale or have the ability to upscale registered dietitians to make them comfortable not only from the numbers and programming, but the practical experience they need to make them successful in combat sports.
Yeah, great. And last question, Charles, if there's someone that's listening to this and they're a final year RD student and they're about to do their internship or they just finished their internship and they went, wow, I want to be the angry dietitian when I grow up and I get into practice, where's the best place for them to start if they want to start this process and start gathering that skill set and that knowledge to be successful in this area?
Sure. So COVID threw us in a bit of a loop, but we do host an annual combat sports summit where we kind of go over at the PI and we kind of go over longitudinal, acute, restorative approaches to the combat athlete for nutrition interventions. But also, at least in the US, we also have the CPSDA, which is a great resource for dietitians to network with all different forms of professional dietetics organizations, from pro football to UFC combat athletes.
Yeah, excellent. All right, Charles, I'll let you get back to your Christmas, but very, very, very last question. Said that three times now, but for real, the last question. If people want to get in contact with you, they want to ask you more questions, they want to pick your brain about any of this, excuse the pun there, how do they get in contact with you?
My Instagram, as you've joked at a couple times, is the Angry Dietitian. So that's probably the easiest way to get in contact with me. And just real quick, there's actually a really good webinar and also in-person conference, the Society of Neurosports. Their annual conference is in March 26th through 27th. So I highly recommend anyone that's interested in not just concussion, but anything related to neuroscience and nutritional interventions for neuroscience to tune in. So just want to say that.
Yeah, absolutely. I keep joking about the angry dietitian because if you ever get the chance to meet Charles, he's probably one of the most humble people you ever meet, very quiet and very, very laid back. And then you watch videos of you hitting pads and training, and it's one of the most terrifying things I've ever seen in my life. And then I actually remember the time when I went, that's why they call him the angry dietitian. I was like, don't step on Charles' toes. That's for sure. But anyway, Charles, thanks so much for coming on, mate. That's awesome. That's a really hot topic at the moment. I've got a lot of questions about concussion and nutrition. So that's pretty much the latest and greatest in the area. So Charles, thanks so much for coming on and Merry Christmas, mate.
Merry Christmas. All the best.
And there it is, another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. Charles is one of the biggest achievers in the field of combat sports nutrition, and his contribution to the growth and success of the UFC nutrition program cannot be understated. As he said, the new UFC PI journal will be available in February 2021, so keep your eyes peeled for the latest from one of the best performance teams in sports. This podcast will be available through the podcast app, iTunes, Spotify, and you'll also be able to download it from my website, www.thefightdietitian.com/podcast. If you enjoy listening to the podcast, then be sure to head to the podcast app to give us a rating and leave us a review. Thanks for listening in, and I'll see you guys for the next episode of the Fight Science Podcast.